evening and welcome to another in our continuing series of programs on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in gray back here, Peggy Wright, with assistance from our Mr. Everything, Haiwan Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Jason Hatman is our library technologist tonight. Our speaker tonight grew up in Kentucky and graduated from the University of Kentucky, where she studied creative writing with Wendell Berry and earned a degree in journalism from the University of Kentucky. In 1993, she won the Seamus Award for her very first novel. Since that time, she's become an international best-selling author of 12 books, published worldwide from Great Britain to Australia. She's been nominated for numerous prizes, and her books have been widely praised both here and abroad. Her latest book, When Secrets Die, was published by Simon & Schuster in 2005. Reviewing The Debt Collector for the Chicago Sun-Times in October 2000, Edward Gilbreth wrote, "I'm a sucker for dogs, so any novelist who in her fourth paragraph introduces a slobbering, three-legged mutt named Clambit. All 106 blonde pounds of him has me hooked for whatever follows." Not that Lynn Hightower needs sentimental gimmicks in her sixth novel of suspense. Her absorbing, fast-paced narrative thrives on its own high-powered energy, plumbing dark recesses in her central players and startling readers with plot twists. Reviewing the same novel for the Washington Post, Bill Kent titled his review, "Menace Lurks Beneath the Surface of Daily Life in a Tale of Psycho-Thrillers and Espionage." He closed his review with the comment, "We've met these people. We can only pray we don't meet them anymore." Hightower's novels have tackled such diverse subjects as female serial killers and lethal debt collectors. Legions of fans have come to love her police procedurals involving Cincinnati's single mother, P.I. Sonora Blair. In 2002, she returned to writing about Lena Padgett, a Lexington, Kentucky P.I. who first appeared in Satan's Lamb in 1993. Reviewing Fortunes of the Dead, Publishers Weekly commented, "The instantly believable and deeply touching way that Hightower maneuvers her private detective, Lena Padgett, shows what a class act she is." Recently moved to Bowling Green, when not writing, Miss Hightower enjoys ballroom dancing, movies, small sports cars, and tame horses. Leo, her talented German shepherd, is said to be never far away. And while she studied French and Italian, she claims to be fluent only in Southern. Don't you believe it? Please join me in welcoming Lynn Hightower.
Thank you, Brian. That was the most fabulous introduction I have ever had. And I would like to hire you to write my bio for my website. And I'm really thrilled that all of you are here. I appreciate you coming very much. My husband's in the audience, and he will agree with Brian that menace does lurk beneath the surface. In fact, on our second date, he said, "You're a mystery writer. If you killed me, where would you hide my body?" And I took him straight to the basement and to the coal chute, and I said, "Right in there." And then I thought, you know, I liked him, and I'm never going to see him again. He lives dangerously. He just called his friends and said, "If I disappear, look in the coal chute." So he's yet to disappear. We have a house without a coal chute. We need one. You know, it's a funny thing about writing. You factor in part of your real life, but you turn it into fiction. But nobody believes. Everybody reads my novels, and they all think it's real. My neighbors are currently reading one of my books, and they keep coming to the door and going, "Okay, when did that happen to you? You poor thing. You know." And it's not true. When I wrote Flashpoint, about a small, petite, blonde female serial killer who handcuffs men to the steering wheel of their cars, douses them with gasoline, and sets them on fire, I will tell you that had nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that I was getting a divorce at the time that I wrote the book. I will say that for a good year after that book came out, I could not get a date with anyone. What the heck? When I was a little girl, I didn't know I was going to be a novelist until I was in the fifth grade. It took me a while to figure out. But I was so good at telling lies, and everyone believed me, that I realized that that was my skill in life. So at that point, I decided you can wear jeans to work, you can tell lies for a living. This career was tailor-made for you. Unlike most children who had imaginary friends, I had an imaginary enemy. I assume that's why I write mysteries and why a body turns up in all of my books. I've tried to write normal things and cannot seem to do it without a sociopath somewhere. So I've just given up, and my son won't read my books. When he was younger, he tried, and then he put it down, and he came to me and he said, "You know, Mom, this just isn't the kind of book a mother would write." And he, he hasn't read them. It took me 8 years to get published, of writing every day. My first agent was a literary agent, life insurance, tanning bed guy out of Philadelphia. And he and I didn't work out. But I did wind up with the William Morris Agency in New York. I sort of snuck in through the back door. I sent some of my chapters off to a literary agent, and I didn't double check and realize that he was the CEO and chairman of the board of the largest literary agency in the world. And I sent him my little note from Kentucky and said, "Hey, how about it?" So he sent me back a very nice letter and suggested that I send my work to Matt Bialer, who was just starting out as an agent with William Morris. So I sent Matt Bialer a letter and I said, "You know, Perry Knowlton of Curtis Brown recommended you." And he said I should send this along. So Matt, of course, was very impressed with that. He called me a week later and he said, "Well, I like your book and I'd like to send it out today." And I sat down in the chair, but the chair wasn't there. I sat in the floor. My voice went up about 3 octaves, and I said, "Well, that would be just great." And then he says, "So tell me when. How'd you get to know Perry?" So I told him the truth, and he thought that was extremely funny. And he said, "You know, I still want to send your book out." But it sort of did get me pushed to the top of the line. And that book didn't sell. He was sending it around, and I had started the first 6 chapters of another book that I wrote. I sold a book on my own, and the publishing company was taken over by Random House, and all the books were axed. And mine was axed 3 months before my publication date. And I was in a bad mood for a year. My children will attest to this. And I started writing this book because I was mad, and I thought, well, you know what? If you're going to be a screw-up, you might as well enjoy it. So I started writing a book with everything I wanted, you know, serial killers, ghosts, drug dealers, underground tunnels, you name it, that was in the book. And I just sent it off to my agent and said, "This is what I'm working on." And he said, "God, I like this." And he sent it to the editor who was reading the novel, and she called him and said, "Look, I hate the book you sent me, but I love these 6 chapters. So I sold on proposal, which is fairly unusual, and he called me when I was cooking dinner one night and said, "Okay, this editor wants to buy your book. She wants a 2-book deal. She's going to call you in 10 minutes. You need to tell her where the rest of the series is going." And I'm thinking, "What series?" And I said, "Right, the series. I will tell her where the series is going." So I promptly locked all of my children in their bedrooms and turned the stove off, and I have no idea what I told her. You know, I just wanted them to think I thought it was a series, and we moved on from there. I would say the hardest thing about being a writer, which I'm only just now sort of figuring out, is that creative work requires your full attention, okay? And so if anything is upsetting you or bothering you or you're angry about it, it's very hard. Look, see, my husband's going to be nodding. It's very hard to focus and write, you know? And he'll say, "How'd you do on your book today?" I'm like, "You upset me this morning before you left. Did you expect me to get any writing done?" You know, and you know, my kids knew that if they wanted to keep the house and get new clothes, that they oughtn't upset me, but they did anyway. I'm just now figuring out how to get into the zone even when I'm upset, which involves playing backgammon on the computer for about 20 minutes. So I'll be hard at work, and people, "Oh, you're writing?" I'll go, "Yeah," and I'm like hiding the computer screen because they don't understand that I have to take that 20 minutes of backgammon before I can go into the book. But you know, if you want a typical day of a writer, when I was a single mother, and I was trying to finish a book called No Good Deed. That's the book that my oldest daughter says I killed her off in. It did involve a child of her age of 15 being murdered and buried under a pile of horse manure, but I swear it was not her. She says it was. She says I described her room exactly like it was. Well, I just, you know, I just used her room. The victim wasn't her, but she doesn't live. And like, here's a typical week, and this is why it's hard to concentrate. The horse in the book is my horse. His name is Hellzapapa. He was my first horse. And you should never buy a horse named Hellzapapa if you don't know anything about horses. And he had only a slight injury, which the horse never healed. And I spent more vet bills on him than I did for my mortgage. But anyway, I went out to ride him, and I had the rest of the book mapped out, and I knew exactly where I was going. And I was like giving myself one last ride before I got back and finished the book. Unfortunately, he got upset over something flapping on the fence and took off, and I fell off and broke my back. But that was the first day of the week. Then after that, a week later, my son went to Chicago with a friend and disappeared. And after 48 hours of, I'm a mystery writer, I knew the terrible things that happened to him, I got a call from the Broome County Jail up near Cincinnati, where he had been arrested for driving barefooted, my son the criminal. And he admitted that he'd been in jail, and his bail was $8. And could I please come and get he and his friend Marvin out? So I did go and bust Alan and Marvin out of jail, and went to the evidence room to get the machete that they had in the back seat, and you know, kind of felt like Bob Barker. And So when you have when I went to get him, we had to go pick up the car, which had been impounded. And because I had broken my back and was in a lot of pain, Alan drove me home and his good friend drove his car home. And as soon as the boys were settled and I thought, you know, I can get back to work, they called and said, Mom, we really don't want to tell you this since you just got out of jail, but we did drive my car into a fence and you need to come and get us. And, you know. So my point being that it is very hard sometimes to concentrate on your work and meet your deadlines when you have a normal life, if this is a normal life. I don't know if my life is normal or not. It seems like I'm a magnet for weirdness, but I think all of us are to some degree or another. Okay. My first book, when I had my first book signing at Joseph Beth, the reviewer in the Lexington Herald Leader did not like the book. She said it was very derivative, and that it was like Lethal Weapon and, what were the movies? Lethal Weapon and Silence of the Lambs and a couple other fabulous movies all rolled into one book, and that was just ridiculous. And I had a line all the way to the door because everybody said, we read that review, and if your book is like Lethal Weapon and Silence of the Lambs all rolled into one, we all want to buy your book. So after that, I never got upset over bad reviews, even when the Herald took me to task for Fortunes of the Dead because I got some directions wrong in the book. And, you know, so I just want to forewarn all of you that read my books, you cannot follow the directions in my book and expect to get where I say you're going to get. Now, my kids, instead of sympathizing with me, I thought they were going to call and say, oh, Mom, that was so mean. They called. They were laughing. They said, you know, you can never find your way anywhere. Why they possibly expect you to get your directions right in a book? But anyway, so I just want to forewarn you. You cannot use my book like MapQuest, or you will. My other fabulous signings have included one where only my mom came, and she bought several books, and she said she was going to tell them, you know, she was my mom, and I begged her not to. I said, please pretend like you're just somebody that likes to read. Not sure. I was once flown to Florida and sold no books. I was once put up at the Ritz-Carlton in Georgia in Atlanta and sold no books. See, you just can't imagine how glad I am to see all of you now. I am going to do a reading. Let me see how much time is. I got lots of time. I'm going to do a reading, and then I may answer some questions. If you don't have any, I'll tell you some more stories. This bit of the novel is based on this character is a coroner in, I guess we're in Lexington, and he is one of the characters who comes to the rescue of the hero and the heroine when she's accused of Munchausen by proxy, and they're trying to figure out what actually did kill her son and what might be making her sick. So this is from his viewpoint. But the story he tells about the accident is a true story. If you tell me a story, or you make a witty comment, or you do a little bit of conversation that sounds good, I warn you in advance, I will steal it and I will put it right in the book. And this is a story that my realtor told me, and found to his great surprise, and his family story of tragedy was right there on page 59 of my next book. Marcus had no idea who she was, this woman who called him up at 7:30, well past office hours, and who did not seem surprised to find him working late. From her voice, he could tell that she was old, from the accent that she'd grown up in the coal mine regions of eastern Kentucky. She knew his name, the number of his private line, and talked to him as if they'd just resume a conversation that had been interrupted but was still on track. "Ma'am," he said. The flow of her conversation slowed and eased away like she gently applied mental brakes. "I didn't catch your name. Did you say Calhoun?" "I did, sir. Jodina Calhoun. I met you 7 years ago when my daughter died. You remember when that ambulance got hit at the railroad crossing?" The image was instantaneous, a flashback launching the post-traumatic stress that had haunted him more and more these last years. A flicker of images moved through his mind like pictures rotating on a Rolodex until he was in the middle of the memory and he was once again listening to the crunch of his boots on the snow and the ice. A deputy led the way with a flashlight, the cone of illumination jittering as the man's hand shook. It was a long walk that they had to approach from the back of the train and thread their way past 16 boxcars. The intermittent rotation of emergency lights lured them toward the wreckage. Every police car in the county was there, as well as a fire truck and two ambulances, one on its side, crumpled like a wadded ball of tinfoil, the top of the ambulance sliced open and lying upside down in the snow. And still the lights from the roof flashed, and the glow of red played against the frozen road, as if the ambulance were a living creature, dying slowly now, only able to light the way to disaster. The deputy was muttering something that sounded like a prayer. There was none of the swift and mumbled pleasantries common between professionals at disaster sites. The familiar and worn groove of surface-friendly greetings used to separate the worker bees from the victims, their way of assuring themselves that their world was still intact. There were no macabre witticisms or dark, dirty humor, because no one ever indulged rude, humorous tendencies in Franklin's presence more than once. Kentucky was a small state, professionally speaking, and word had gone out fast. Marcus Franklin was infuriated by disrespect to civilians in life or in death, and words came to him like bullets when delivering a reprimand. That part of socializing he found effortless. The professionals hadn't liked him the first years, the cops, the doctors, emergency techs. He wasn't good with people. His world had settled heavily on his shoulders before he'd taken the state medical examiner's job. He was awkward with people he didn't know well, resigned to the shy and out of place feeling that had dogged him from birth. Gradually, the friction had worn smooth. Too many people had a friend or a family member who remembered Marcus with sober gratitude. He returned their phone calls. He answered awkward questions. If you wanted to know how much your loved ones suffered, what it was that really killed them, he would be honest and as easy as he could. He returned the suicide notes after investigation closed, and no juicy details got out of his office with any degree of regularity. Anyone on his staff from gossip didn't last. Reporters were treated with terse civility, guilty until proven innocent. But if they were careful with their words and more so with their facts, he'd open up a little if he could. Otherwise, they might as well not exist. A lot of the patrol officers didn't like him. The ones who did had been the few who had been unable to control their physical reactions to mayhem and found not humiliation but steadiness, tolerance bordering on actual kindness, and a strong presence that made them confident, as if the good guys were still in charge. His presence made everyone stand up straighter and watch their language, but it also gave them the lift of spirit and sense of relief one feels when the cavalry arrives. He inspired confidence, if not affection. Marcus knew it and accepted the responsibility, and it rode him hard, like all the other responsibilities. It kept his chin close to his chest and his shoulders slightly hunched. The sheriff had told him that an ambulance had tried to be a train, a tragic decision that had cost the life of the patient they were trying to save, as well as the entire crew. That's how it looked in the beginning. Later, they would learn that the crossing arm had been torn away and the signal lights had not flashed, though the bell had rung. The train was part of the coal line running without lights and no scream of the horn as it crisscrossed the countryside so as not to disturb the handfuls of houses and farms in the area. Near the interstate, it was another story, with lights and noise and as much commotion as possible. But the trains ran constantly out in rural areas, and the locals did not appreciate listening to the horn day in and day out. The ambulance driver had never known the train was there. Not until impact, when the roof of the ambulance was ripped off, the driver decapitated. The attending tech and nurse in the back of the ambulance bent over the woman whose heart was refusing to start, were thrown sideways and crushed. The conductor applied the brakes as soon as he saw the first flash of light, but the train had been going in excess of 45 miles per hour, and he didn't see the ambulance in the train till the train was right up on it. The metal apron of the engine caught the edge of the metal gurney where the patient lay and dragged her 300 feet down the track. When the train finally stopped, her head and upper torso were still wedged into the side of the train. The gurney had shattered, and Marcus Franklin had to insist that the track and the ground be gone over and over again until every mutilated piece was found. The woman was named Karen Calhoun Mattingly. She had been 57 years old, a widow, and the grown daughter of Jodina Calhoun. She had suffered a massive heart attack 40 minutes before the ambulance crew arrived to try and revive her. The nurse and tech were both intent on bringing her around to the best of their ability, and were aware of nothing but their patient when the ambulance collided with the train. 3 seconds after impact, the tech was dead. The nurse, infused with a stubborn life force, lingered 4.5 minutes before her brain bowed to the possibility of keeping the body alive. There would be no open caskets at these funerals. As Marcus made his way along the track, he noticed a slender woman standing near the engine. She had been swallowed whole by a big green barn coat, the kind you might buy at a feed store, and she had her back turned to the wreckage. As he got closer, he realized that she was watching him. The glare of working lights set up by deputies made her eyes look black, her face worn and seamed. She was, in fact, 73 years old the night of the accident, and she was Karen Calvin Mattingly's mother. She had been following the ambulance in her Chevrolet Impala because there had not been room in the back for her to ride alone. She had not seen the train until it knocked the ambulance sideways and had slammed on her brakes, looking away as the top of the ambulance was sheared off and the driver decapitated. When she looked back up, she had seen the metal flash of her daughter's gurney as it was caught up on the apron of the engine, had seen the white sheet that covered Karen blowing backward. It happened so quickly that by the time her mind processed what she saw, it was over. But that thing wrapped around the right side of the engine had been Karen. There was no mistaking that quick glimpse of her daughter as she was caught midsection and lifted, her head tilted sideways, her hair streaming in the violent thrust of the wind. Enough is a true story, and the little bit of truth in there, that green barn coat, which is mine, and I did buy it at a feed store. Now, does anybody have any questions about writing or books or reading or the weather or whatever?
So yes. It's again early in the morning and work until lunch or through lunch and then to the dinner hour?
It just depends on the day.
No interruptions.
You know, that's what drives me crazy is interruptions. I mean, if I cannot work if there are a lot of people in the house, and I thought that I was being really difficult, but I've talked to a bunch of my friends who are writers, and they said the same thing, because even if no one interrupts you, the thought that they might interrupt you creates just a little air of tension. And then I just read in Oprah magazine while I was supposed to be working over here that when you're really engaged, your mind is really engaged, and someone interrupts you, it takes 23 minutes to get your thought processes back together. But still, people interrupt me all the time. My kids used to until they got every time they interrupted me in my office, I gave them a chore like scrub the toilet, so they quit pretty quickly. I never know why and where I can work where I work. Sometimes I can work at home when it's completely silent, and sometimes I need to be out around people and just have the energy of other people, and I guess no distractions like go watch Dr. Phil or put in a load of laundry or, throw the ball to the dog. Sometimes I'll sit here or I'll go out. I used to work in airports quite a lot, but after 9/11, I couldn't do that anymore. I used to go to Bluegrass Field and go from terminal to terminal every 45 minutes. First part of the book would start at Eastern, I'd move over to Delta, there would be time for coffee, then we'd go over United Air, and then back again if I still had, Walmart. But, that's all. Any other questions? Yeah.
How much time do you think when you're doing a novel you put into research?
Research? I do quite a lot of research. The internet is heavenly. Used to be I would spend literally months tracking people down, going to libraries, arranging childcare, now I just go online, wireless, and it's quick. You have to be very careful. I was a journalism major, so I have to have three sources before I believe something, but on the internet, everybody's quoting each other. You have to be very careful, because a lot of times it's some 12-year-old's website, and everybody's referring back to that. You do have to be careful of that. I talk to professionals a lot. I talk to, do dialogues with the police. I went to an autopsy when I did Flashpoint. Had to arrange child care. And there was a coroner, he was very impressive. He was kind of like Franklin, although it's not modeled on him. I was very impressed with how considerate he was of his victims and their families. And how before I came, he talked to me about how I couldn't use any details, from the actual cases that I saw or we discussed. And he did let wait. He knew I had three little kids at the time, so he would call me every morning and tell me what bodies he had. And I didn't, I didn't like any of them until I got a good murder-suicide question. But they did rule it as a suicide, but I do believe it was a murder. He waited an hour while I drove up to Louisville after getting my kids on the road. And I worked with the ATF on Fortunes of the Dead. Sometimes police professionals or law enforcement people don't want to work with writers, and that's fine. It hurts my feelings, but that's okay. I always realize that A, I'm writing fiction, so there's no excuse for doing anything that's going to hurt somebody's real-life professional life. And, like I told the ATF when they first wouldn't work with me, that's fine, I can get whatever I want off the internet, but I just wanted, your take and your authenticity. I had actually set up an interview with the office in Lexington, and I was on the way when one of the guys called me and said, "I'm sorry, the boss doesn't like you, and he won't talk to you." So I had originally been in touch with their office, their media people in D.C., and I just sent them an email and I said, "Is there anybody else I can talk to?" And they said, "Nope, sorry." I know what it was. What made them mad is because someone who worked with the ATF turned out to be the killer. And they didn't like the idea that a law enforcement would go bad. Such a bizarre thought. We know that never, ever happens. And so I sent an email, and I wanted to say something mean, but I held my temper so proud. And I just sent them a nice email, and I said, "I'm sorry, it didn't work out." And then that email got kicked up to his boss, Tracy Height. And she thought, "Oh, it is so juvenile." So she called me on the phone, and I picked up, and she said, "This is Tracy Height with ATF." And I said, "I have phone service, thank you, AT&T, but I am not interested." And I was hanging up the phone when I heard this voice scream, This says alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, not AT&T. And so she set me up with a man who runs the Tennessee and Kentucky alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, the whole thing. And he was wonderful. I asked him, this is what I like to do with law enforcement. I'll give them a little of the plot and tell them what I'm going to do. And they always go, oh, that is not
what we would do.
And so I said, well, what would you do? And I did this up in Cincinnati, too, with those cops. And I just fill my note peg up and listen to them and let them plot my book for me authentically. And I did that with the ATF. I did it with Flashpoint up in Cincinnati. And, you know, it's so much easier when they do all the work. And I am very, you know, lazy. I will let them do the work. So he was really good. And they even took me in the evidence room and let me hold all the guns and stuff. And kept asking me, please don't. It's not loaded. Please don't point that at me. Thank you very much. And they're actually fabulous. I've had an awful lot of help. I did, I don't know if anybody saw the news section yesterday on the Midday Live, but I was telling them about the ride-along I did with the Lexington Police Department. And I wanted the shift that had the most crime. I wanted the excitement and the danger, right? So that's the, like, midnight to 6 a.m. shift or whatever it is. And I had unfortunately gotten up at 6 that morning and done a whole lot of stuff all day and not taken a nap like I meant to. So, and all night long, all we had was loud music. We'd go to the door, yes, hello, we'd just like to ask you to turn the music down. All night long is all I got. And then right when it was just about over, he gets this phone call, break in progress at the Cheapside Bar. And I'm like, oh, yes! So he's beating off and telling me how he takes his sister for ride-alongs, and she's always like, stop driving so fast, I'm going to tell Mom on you if you don't quit speeding. And he's like, this is my job. But he's telling me that. We go to the Cheapside Bar. The plate glass window is shattered. The alarm's going. There's lights. So he goes a little bit down the block. He locks me in. I see these cruisers coming in slowly with their lights off. He draws his gun, and he says, don't get out of the car, whatever you do. Okay, so I'm all locked in, and I'm just watching. And the last thing I remember is seeing three cops crouched, sort of duck walking with their guns out, going toward the bar. And then the next thing I remember is the sound of a whole bunch of men laughing. And they're laughing, and they're laughing, and I have fallen asleep with my face pressed against the window. And since my cheek was stuck to the glass, I had to have been drooling, which is very embarrassing. And they can't get in the car. It's locked. I don't know whether once they lock it from whatever they've done, I don't know where they left the keys in it or what. He couldn't get in. And they couldn't wake me up because I was so deeply asleep. And they were just getting so tickled, they were all just doubling over, laughing. Oh, yeah, this writer, once all the excitement, shame she couldn't stay awake, you know, for us to catch the criminal, but oh well, you know. That, you know, that's just more of my wonderful reputation. Yeah. But that's just me. So, any questions? Any more questions, somebody? Yeah.
What are the difficulties in getting published?
The difficulties in getting published? Those stupid people in New York don't recognize good fiction when they see it. We all know that, right? That is the difficulty. So we just have to write so well that those idiots get it through their head they need to publish our book. And I apologize to those who've heard this story before, okay? It took me 8 years to get published, but I know it won't take you that long. It couldn't. I'm just smug. And I used to be very mature when I was rejected. I would sit on the couch and sob. And then reward myself with a cookie and maybe go out for a margarita later that night. And I remember when my oldest daughter was 3, and she comes in, toddling in to their grandbabies, and I'm sitting on the couch just crying like a baby. And she comes up, and she's, you know, sucking her fingers, and she goes, oh, poor mommy. Did you get another rejection? And I said, why, yes, I did. And she said, why won't they publish you? And I thought, what a great moment in parenting. I can set such a good example. And I said, well, you know, here's the thing. You have to work so hard. You have to be so talented and do so well and not give up that they can't turn you down. And she thinks about it a minute, and she pats me on the shoulder and says, and you're not doing that, why? Anybody else have a thought or a question or a comment? Yeah?
How much time do you spend writing versus rewriting?
That's a good question. Writing versus rewriting? Well, there's so many stages of rewriting. Okay? You write your first draft, and of course it's brilliant. But then you go back and go through it and make your changes. Now, if you've got time and you're not on deadline and in a great deal of trouble, which could happen to some of us if they procrastinate, I wouldn't know. I even like to read it out loud because there's a rhythm of the words and the work, and it also really shows you mistakes, you know, that don't sound right. And then you send it in, but you know, they keep sending it back to you with suggestions and things for you to do and revisions for you to make. So there's your own revisions, your agent's revisions, your editor's revisions, your copy editor's revisions, and then the final proof revisions. So how much time do you spend doing revisions? Quite a lot, you know, quite a lot. One thing I do that helps me is every book I try to have a music for, and certain music I like to listen to with certain books. So you send it off to the publisher, you're not in love with it anymore, you're working on something else, and it lands on your desk, and you think, I could just throw up rather than read the stupid book again. And you turn that music on, and you put your mind back in the place you were when you were writing the book. So that helps. Of course, you all could probably just not to do it right in the first place, and not as much, but you know. The thing about revisions, I used to get upset about them, I don't anymore, because you have a vision of what you want the book to be and what you want it to accomplish. And because you're so familiar with it, it's very hard, you know, for you to realize here's where your book is and here's where you want it to be, okay? So if someone gives you some good advice on how you get it up there, you listen. And there's a little bell, you know, they say something, you go, you know, I knew all along that that was a problem, but I just, you know, convinced myself it wasn't because I didn't want to read the stupid book one more time. You know, so the little bell goes off. And many copy editors have saved me from great embarrassment in print. So I usually pay very close attention. But most of them are pretty good. So, who else has a question or a thought?
What are you working on now?
What am I working on now? I'm working on a thriller. I'm back to, I'm always doing sociopaths. I can't help it. There's a lot of new information on serial killers and sociopaths. They even now have a scale of evil. How about that? It's very unusual for a forensic psychiatrist to even mention the word evil. I do have a friend who's a forensic psychiatrist, and I was asking him some of the questions about the book, because the book is not just about the killer, it's about redemption. Can someone who is a sociopath change their ways? And are they just conning you when they say they want to? And we have a sociopath just literally haunting this woman, and he's just sure that she can put him on the path to righteousness, except is that what he really is after? Because, you know, how many people is he killing trying to find that path, you know? So I've discussed this a lot with a friend of mine who is a forensic psychologist who does work with some very scary people. He offered to put me in touch with a couple of very trusted people. He said, of course, you're going to have to be very careful because the prisons are close to here, and if they can find you, they will. And I'm thinking, no, you know, I'll just stick with talking to you and making shit up, you know, because I live in Bowling Green, and, you know, I'm at 440 all the time, and I'm not hard to drive down. So I wimped out, absolutely. He's like, you know, I got one that just loves blondes. I want to know, thank you. Peter, really, I appreciate this so much, but thank you very much. He said, really, he's really interesting. He's so disassociated that he only comes to himself when the blood is all over the... Thank you. No, thanks. So, yeah. Yeah?
Yeah. Do you write more than one book at a time and put one down, or do you just focus on one
That's book? An interesting question, because... I try to just write one at a time, but I've got three books in my head right now. And sometimes when I get a scene from them, I'll just stop and write that scene down. But the problem is, you know, this book has to get finished, so I've got to focus completely on it. But the problem is, when you're working on a book, and you're through the honeymoon phase, and you're into the marriage of the book, which is all the problems, and where you and that book are not getting along, then the other books look so good, you know. It's like, you know, flipping through GQ and saying, you know, he's cute. I bet he would never get mad at me for, you know, leaving my curlers all over the bathroom, you know, that kind of thing. So it's better to stick with it. Although this book I'm working on right now, I'm incredibly excited about, and it's going extremely well now, but The first version I did of it was really bad. It was horrible. And I knew I had to rewrite it, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I, Diana knows this. She and I talked about it. Diana is an upcoming volume writer who will be up behind this podium very soon. But I was talking to a girlfriend of mine, Pam Walker, who writes YA novels. And I said, you know, this book has given me fits. And she said, all right, tell me all about it. And I talked to her, she listened to me, and she said, well, it's pretty clear to me that you're really excited about this side character and bored to death with your heroine, and you're telling the entire book from the wrong viewpoint. And she said, I don't know if that's good news or bad news. But it was good news. I had to rewrite the entire book, and it's taken me another year, but I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning with the new chapter and viewpoint in my head, and it's gone great ever since then. And, you know, some of the books that I've wrestled with the absolute most and torn my hair out and thought this is never, ever going to work turn out to be my absolute best ones once I finally get it figured out. Although if she hadn't said that, I might still be beating my head against the wall and screwing it up very badly. I don't know. I've got two right now in my head that I want to do.
Well, how do you like Bowling Green? Do you ever foresee a book being set here?
Yeah, of course, because I'm lazy, and I'm not going to make something up, okay? I'm going to write wherever I am. Leo, the lion, my dog now, the German Shepherd, and he's in the book. He's in this book. In fact, if you watch Leo's behavior, he will give you a clue to the killer in this next book. That's all I'm going to say. you know, if I'm seeing something and I'm walking through a restaurant, you know, the restaurants I put in the books are the ones I'm going to be eating at. You know, you must know that I love Billy's Barbecue in Lexington because every book they're sitting there eating at Billy's Barbecue. And, you know, I'm sure 440 will be in a book. I tried writing there while I was drinking martinis. And I had a wonderful time and then went home and read what I wrote. It was very hard to read my writing. And it was interesting, but it really didn't pertain at all to the novel that I was working on. It had to do with quite a few random subjects. And, you know, the thing is, I'm just drinking martinis and writing away and thinking, oh, my God, this is so good. This is, oh, what a life, drinking martinis and writing a book. I could do this every day. Unfortunately, you know, I can't, you know, I'm not Hemingway. I can't pull it off. So, but for one night, it was a great fantasy. This is my new life. I work at 440. And you know, I tell them, I'm sorry, I can't write without martinis. You know, sorry, that's just the creative process. Because you and you're a writer, you can get away with murder. I mean, Robert will tell you everything. I'm sorry, it's the creative process. If you don't go out and buy me glazed donut twists, I can't finish this character. And I'm on deadline. Yeah, so. You know, he's always like, yes, my kids, is this... Do I have to get her the donuts? Is it real? And they're like, just get her the donuts. Just get her the donuts. Let her get the book done, or the money isn't going to come.
Yeah. Other questions?
Did you have one more? Or are you just waving your hand around? No? Okay.
Well, usually about this time then, we have a door prize to give away. And
you'll never guess what it is.